Unlock the past and safeguard your memories with scanmyphotos.com. Here's our special promo code, GODIGITAL, to get a whopping up to 50% off your photo scanning order. Don't let your cherished moments fade away. Digitize them now with precision and care. Whether it's old slides, photos, or films, bring them into the digital age and relive those precious memories. This is an affiliate promotion, meaning we may earn a commission if you take advantage of this fantastic deal. Act fast, preserve your history, and save big with Go Digital at scanmyphotos.com. Hi, I'm Maureen Taylor, the photo detective. I really love family photographs, all of them. From the mystery images you find in shoeboxes and albums, to the pictures you snap with your digital devices. No mystery is too small. A simple question about an image can lead to new stories of your ancestors. This means you can count on me to help you identify the people in them, offer solutions for preserving and organizing them, and yes, even guide you in the various ways to gather and share picture stories with your relatives. My guest today is Dr. Kate Strasden, a dress historian. She was on the podcast earlier talking about her work with historical clothing, and she has a brand new book out. Kate, I'll let you talk about the title, but we did allude to it a little bit in the last podcast, and I can't wait to dig into this book because I love it. Thank you for sending me an advance copy.
Oh, bless you. Thanks for having me back again. It's lovely to be back. Yes, so it is called The Dress Diary of Mrs. Ann Sykes. I think the US version is just going to be called The Dress Diary, and it's Secrets of a Victorian Woman's Wardrobe. So it's a kind of deep dive into this album of dreams that I own, and I've absolutely loved it. It's been a joy to write.
Yeah, it's beautifully written. The book that you have, The Dress Diary of Ann Sykes, is very special. In your book, you mentioned that you only know of one in the United States, maybe two, and only another one in the UK.
Yeah, so they are rare objects, and I don't think that's necessarily because women didn't make very many of them. I think maybe there were more, maybe it was a much more common practice than we might imagine. This idea of sticking in swatches of fabric that belonged to your clothes, your family's clothes, your friend's clothes. I don't think it was necessarily an unusual practice, but I think because it's associated with the kind of female domestic space, they're not the kind of objects that were valued as kind of artistic endeavors. And so oftentimes I think they have been maybe just thrown away or cut up, or they haven't survived intact. So now they certainly are very rare.
So based on that small amount of evidence, right, what do you think of all of this? I mean, the Dress Diary of Anne includes clippings, little swatches of her own clothes, but also some of her friends and a couple of men, right? A couple of men's samples.
Yeah, some.
I mean, is this like a dream book of these are my favorite clothes and these are my favorite dresses from my friends, and I aspire to have a dress in the same fabric? I mean, do we have any idea of what the thought was behind creating these other than just as a memory book?
She's very sparse in her entries. So she writes, I mean, most time in the third, in fact, all bar one swatch, she writes everything in the third person. So she refers to everybody, you know, even herself. She says, Ann Sykes's dress, 1842. So everything is written with kind of distance. I think she herself had a really varied wardrobe. So I don't think it was necessarily that these were kind of aspirational garments. I think I see it as a kind of autograph album. I see it as a means of her capturing the memories of her friends and family, but also just those people who were much more fleeting in her life. So you do get the people that feature throughout, across decades in the album, but you also get people that might just appear on one page. And that idea that, you know, we all meet people in our lives, just that we might really enjoy their company for an afternoon or whatever, and then we didn't see them again. So I think it was her way of just gathering all of these people that she encountered across her life, whether they were in it for a long time or just a shorter amount of time, and using cloth as that very powerful kind of memory enhancer of seeing a pattern and going, oh yeah, I remember that person really well. So yeah, I think it is more of an autograph album, actually.
I mean, fabric, right? There's color, there's texture, there's memory.
Yeah.
It's all connected.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And she did that very well. I think, you know, it's such a vibrant period. It runs from the 1830s through to the 1870s. And you just see all of the changes that take place across those decades, just in these scraps of cloth.
And the other examples that you've seen are in the same time frame, right?
Pretty much. It does seem to be something that it's the one in the V&A in London, the Victoria and Albert Museum, is slightly earlier. So it goes from the late 18th century through to the early 19th century. That had more of a financial aspect to it, in that the keeper, Barbara Johnson, was an unmarried woman who was managing her budget. So she would fix these pieces of cloth into the ledger that she used, and she would write down how much she had paid per yard. And it seems to be, it has a fairly pragmatic element to it. So that's slightly earlier. There's a great example belonging to somebody called Ida Jackson in the Brooklyn Museum, collection of the Brooklyn Museum. That runs from the mid-19th century through to the turn of the 20th century. And there are a couple others. So yes, they do seem to be largely a sort of late, long 19th century practice that had died out by the sort of 1910s, 1920s.
And you were never able to find any sort of article in like a women's magazine or a newspaper that sort of said, this is that kind of thing you should create.
No, I mean, I did find there were lots of examples of the actual practice of albumization, of making albums. In fact, Mark Twain had companies that, you know, made those
scrapbooks,
didn't they, with the gummed pages. And so I did find lots of articles about encouraging women to do these kinds of, whether it was pressing flowers or whether it was poetry scraps or things like that. But not so much this practice of recording dress in that way. And there are albums that include fabric, but they might relate to business records or, you know, people that were working in weaving sort of factories or places that required you to keep a record of colorways and patterns. So, yeah, it is just such an unusual object.
Mm. It's so lovely. I don't know if I told you this, but I have a small collection of Godey's ladies books, and just because I love them. And I opened one, and in it was a little plaid swatch. And I was like, oh, and I closed it back up. I didn't want to lose it, but it's
amazing.
This bright red, must be a silk. And it was used maybe as a little bookmark because it wasn't near a dress pattern.
No. And once they've been trapped in the pages like that, the color is just so bright, isn't it? Because that's what, you know, I find throughout, these swatches have retained all of their color because they were protected from any light. So it's surprising how really, really vivid they are.
And we can look at fashion illustrations from the period and we can sort of say, well, maybe this is the dress she wore in this fabric, but we don't know. There's nothing, there's no sketches in her dress diary to let us know that.
No, nothing. And I think, so it's making that leap between, on the one hand, so if she was quite good at writing specific dates down, certainly years. So you sort of can make this leap between, if she's written, you know, 1838 above a swatch, you can track back to fashion plates from that particular year, or you can look at surviving garments that have been dated to that in museums, and then you have to kind of it takes a leap of the imagination to see this bright swatch. And some of the patterns are honestly wild. They look like they have just, you know, they could have been produced in the 60s, or they really are amazingly modern looking. And you have to kind of imagine them from being this kind of 3 inches square into a whole garment or a cloak or a, you know, an evening dress or something, and then they take on a whole other dimension because they are wild.
They are wild, especially some of the swatches from, where did she live? Did she live in, was it India?
She lived in Singapore for a time.
Singapore. Yeah. Those swatches.
They are. I know.
They're crazy when you think about this little swatch that jumps off the page at you and is so bright it practically hurts your eyes with the brightness, the brilliance of the color, and then you think, this in a ball gown?
Yeah. I think
you walk into the room and the whole room goes, whoa, quiet.
Yes. And right. Especially if everyone else is wearing similar, and it was just a riot. It must have been absolutely, I think we talked about this last time, didn't we? The idea that we can have a tendency to imagine the 19th century in black and white because that's how we see the photographs. And when you look at these surviving fabrics, you realize that, you know, it was anything but. They were absolutely brilliantly colored.
Yes. I have a small, you know, you can see my office behind me. I have one shelf that's growing of, like, well, the yearbook will end up on that shelf, of fabric swatches and things from the 19th century, or you know, these are the colors in the fabrics and these are some of the patterns, because I really like looking at them and then trying to match them up with one of the photographs that I'm looking at.
Yeah. And I've had a lovely example this week, in fact. So there was one name in the book that I mention as somebody called Miss Garnett, who was, I could never find anything out about her. There were no convenient kind of dates or anything in the records. So she remained unknown, but her clothes were so bright. The swatches in the album with her name against it. And I got this sense of personality. And just this week, I've had an email from somebody who said, oh, well, I know who that is. That's somebody called Martha Garnett, and gave me information and sent me a photograph of her wearing this striped gown that looks fairly, you know, I mean, it could be just obviously shades of grey, but it looks very similar to one of the swatches in the album. It could be the same one. And it's bright green and black. So if it's that dress, it's really, really incredibly bright. So yeah, that was a good example this week of a picture and possibly a garment.
That's pretty fabulous. Are you going to put that on your Twitter feed?
I think so. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I can't wait. I can't wait because I love your Twitter feed. You know, people say, oh, are you going to stay on Twitter? I'm going to stay on Twitter for Kate Strasden. Sorry.
Oh, thanks. Well, I think, you know, there are nice corners of social media. And I think ours is one of them.
Definitely. So what about the samples from Friends? Why did she include those? I mean, and who's making these dresses? Because are these dresses that are being discarded and she takes a little snip? Or is this fabric that she knows her friends are making dresses, or they're having dresses made? I mean, where do these swatches come from?
Yes, it's the latter. So this is very much the period where women were still buying a length of cloth from a bolt of fabric that they would go to a haberdasher or a draper or a warehouse, and they would buy so many yards of, and very often if you read in books, it will say, I bought a, Jane Austen in earlier in the century says, you know, I bought a gown. What she means is, when she says she bought a gown, she means she bought a length of fabric that will be made into a gown. So this is the period where women are buying the cloth and then taking it to their dressmaker, having that conversation then about what a garment will be, or what it will consist of, how they would like it to look. And inevitably then there are scraps left over, because you're the owner of the fabric, and the dressmaker will return the finished garment to you, and also any scraps of fabric. So that's how Anne was acquiring these scraps. She wasn't kind of accosting her friends in the corridor with a pair of shears, coming after them with scissors. They were at some point when they knew that she was creating this album, she was requesting the kind of leftover scraps from their gowns for her album. So yeah, that was very much the way it worked then.
Amazing. And the first swatch is annotated by her husband, right? This is the gown my Anne wore.
Yeah, yeah, it's lovely. And I think maybe there's a sense that this book was a wedding gift. So it was, the book itself is just slightly larger than A4 size. And originally it would have been, I think, maybe an inch or two thick. It's paper, it's a paper cover, marbled paper cover with a red leather spine. And then Anne covered it in this bright pink silk book cover that she sewed onto the actual marbled paper of the album. So it started out maybe a couple of inches thick, but over time has grown as she added more and more of the swatches. And so it's this really sort of distortedly thick album now with so many of the swatches inside it. So yeah, the book is over 400 pages long, but because there's over 2000 swatches in there, it's just enormous. It's this great kind of wodge of an album now.
I don't know if I expected you to say 2000 swatches and 400 pages. No, in my mind, it was like, you know, 15, 20 pages. No, I hadn't really focused on the size of it.
And I think that's what makes this one unique, because it's certainly larger than, I mean, I think this is not me. Ooh, it's bigger than Barbara Johnson's album, but the Barbara Johnson album, which is very famous and very significant for the window it offered to researchers. I think there's sort of maybe just less than 200 samples in that one. So for this one to have over 2000, it's vast, the amount of stuff that's in there and the stuff that I'd still like to do, you know, that I still think there are many stories that could emerge. Well, as I found this week with Martha Garnett, and there's still things to find.
Oh, there's still things to find. Mm. I mean, with that many samples and that many pages, of course there are.
Yeah.
She had a lot of clothes.
She did. She did. She had grown up. So she's a comfortable woman. This is somebody who, she grew up in Lancashire in the UK, in England. She was born in 1816, and her father, James Burton, was a cotton spinner, and he was very comfortable. So she's grown up in a very comfortable sort of middle class, new industrialist family, and they have money. So she has a sizable wardrobe. I haven't actually ever, I should do it sometime, counted just how many swatches belong to her to try and account for how much she was buying each year. But yeah, and it covers the full range of printed cotton gowns, silk evening dresses, ribbons, lace. There's the whole range of different things there that demonstrate that she was able to purchase this kind of stuff.
So have you done an analysis by year?
No, I haven't. As you see, that's another thing I think it would be a really useful thing to try and calculate. I mean, sometimes it might be that she's having the extent to which women would do things like remodel earlier gowns because cloth was
expensive.
But I think that would be a great thing to do, is just to try and quantify exactly how much she herself was buying each year, just to get a sense of what one woman's wardrobe looked like. And it runs, so they married in 1838 and she stopped keeping the album by the mid-1870s. You get a real sense, the handwriting changes, it gets bigger, she writes less, she's not quite so careful in the way that she was cutting out the fragments. So I think there's a sense by the 1870s that she's just kind of had enough of it now and has maybe lost interest in being so detailed about it. So yeah, it would be great to maybe chart those decades that she includes.
That would be fascinating. Yeah, fascinating. And then maybe find photographs of women wearing that fabric.
Yes.
That's
the other thing. So I know, for example, she writes about particular printworks in the book, the Primrose printworks, which was in Clitheroe in Lancashire, and the Broad Oak printworks. And I know, for example, there are some scientists and other researchers working on pattern books in the National Archive in London from those particular printworks. And so we're doing some work together to see whether or not we can match up patterns to see if some of the samples that feature in Anne's book are actually in these business archives.
Ooh, I love those swatch books from textile. The first time I ever saw one in an archive that I worked in, I was like, this is it. I'm in love.
Yeah.
So what for the photographs? But, you know, I spent my entire career working on the photographs, but I still think about those swatch books, which are just amazing. sample books. Mm. I think Anne doesn't go far enough in her book. So I am trying to create a dress diary page that people can use. I have clothing that I've greatly loved, but I might not have a picture of myself in it. Or significant dresses where we could write the story of that dress and that day. So mm-hmm. I'm going to encourage people not only to buy your book, but to create a sort of Anne Sykes dress diary mm-hmm. where they mention something about if they have a picture of themselves or a swatch of their favorite dress. Yeah. At one point in my life, I made a lot of my clothes, but I don't have any of those anymore. I got rid of them all. But I'm thinking in particular of like my wedding dress, and which I still have, and fond memories of going and picking it out with my mom. You know,
isn't it? It's so vivid. I think even if you are not particularly somebody that's interested in fashion, we can all think of a garment in our life that was there at a significant moment, and that garment would really bring that point in time back to life again. I think that's the power of cloth and dress, is that it has that ability to take you back to that place. It isn't all about fashion. It's just about how sort of significant clothes can be in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Or we hold on to our favorite objects, our favorite mm-hmm. clothing. Like I ask people all the time, what's the oldest article of clothing in your closet? Mm-hmm. Come on, confess.
Yeah.
I just got rid of a jacket. That's all I'm going to say. And I was like, when did I buy this jacket? I'm like, this jacket is going. But did I take a swatch of it first? No, I did not. Do I have a picture of myself wearing it? No, I do not, which is totally ridiculous. So I'd like to sort of stop that and sort of think about it in terms of another way of looking at your family photographs and thinking about the stories in the object that people are wearing. I have a couple of unrelated to the dress diary questions, like that, you know, this is an opportunity. I have.
Go for it.
You, the dress historian.
Yes, let's do it.
So I do a talk called Oddices and Bustles, Beards and, you know, whatever. It's a fashion history through photography. Yeah. And this one particular group was like, really, nobody ever asked me this question, but they were super into the history of the bustle. Mm. And, you know, I have since, there's a new book called Butts, a Backstory by Heather Radke that I'm reading, where she's done some research in it. And she says, it's just one of those things that just popped up out of nowhere. Mm. And then other people say, no, this is incredibly related to the depiction of African-American women in this period. What say you?
I think There are all sorts of things. Partly it is just that cycle of change that is often driven by technology. So I think if you look at this, the period of time that this covers, you have gone from the 1840s, 1850s, where everything is sewn by hand, everything, because there's no other way of doing it. Yeah. Early mid 1850s, the sewing machine comes along and speeds up production, really speeds up the amount of time it takes to make a whole garment, say a dress. And one train of thought is that suddenly you have a point where the same amount of money that, so if a dressmaker charges, say, a certain amount of money because it takes her a week to make a dress, just as a for instance, and then the sewing machine comes along and can make that within 2 days. Well, then that's a problem for dressmakers because they can't, you know, they're not making the same amount of money. So one school of thought is that if you have dresses that become increasingly elaborate in terms of trimmings and complexity, and then dressmakers can therefore, a dress will take the same amount of time to make as it did when it was hand stitched. Now you look at that first bustle period of the 1870s, they are enormously elaborate with the amount of trimmings and the ruching and the construction of them, which is very complex. So yes, so there's one kind of sense that this was a response, a kind of natural response of tastemakers to make sure that dresses still take a certain amount of time to make, which I think is quite an interesting idea. It kind of makes sense, you know, you don't want to lose your income. And so I think the other kind of point to make is that when we look at how body parts rise and fall and come in and out of fashion, it does happen. You know, in recent years, we have the waist has always been a subject of kind of fetishization in Western kind of global North contexts. But so has, if you think about the kind of Kardashian big butts, that is not so very different. It's just that we enhance body parts in a different way now through what you might call the invisible corset, or through it being more about the actual body itself, the physicality itself. And it's just that in earlier times, the dress did all that work for you.
Mm. Yeah. But it's sort of like, why didn't people smile in photographs? We may never know unless we find something written down somewhere. What's the true, what's the true reason? What's the true story?
Yeah.
So let's talk about waist for a minute, because I did have someone tell me, now I always assumed that there is that period where the waist's very small. Women are incredibly corseted, except that I had someone say that wasn't actually true, that it was the photographer who edited the images to make the waist look smaller.
That's true. So my previous research before the dress diary was looking at the wardrobe of Queen Alexandra, who was Queen Victoria's daughter-in-law. And she was somebody who was very, very conscious of her public image, right at the point where studios, photographic studios, were taking celebrity portraits, photographic portraits, in vast numbers. But and Alexandra was pretty much the most photographed woman of her generation. There were millions of photographs of her out there. And she sanctioned all sorts of kind of post-production edits on her images. So I've seen a couple of pre-edited and post-edited images, and her waist has been, she was very slim anyway, but yeah, her waist has been taken in by the work that they did on the actual glass plate. Her skin, all of that. She had her coronation photograph where she was in her early 60s, the actual publicly released images, she looks like she could be in her 30s. You know, she looks incredibly youthful. But when you look at the unretouched images, she's got very age-appropriate kind of bags under her eyes, but they've all gone in the editing program. Her arms are lovely and smooth, and her waist has been shaved just a little bit.
But there were extreme corsets as well to pull in your waist.
There were, but I think one of the things that's often a kind of myth about the 19th century is that all women were tight lacing, and they definitely, definitely weren't. You look at, for example, if you look at surviving garments in museums, the waist sizes on them are surprisingly not as extreme as you might think. And so some women did tight lace in the same way that some women go to extreme lengths of diet or body modification now to achieve certain looks. But actually the norm, the corset was just a normal garment that most women wore, but weren't tight lacing. So they used it to give a bit of shape and structure, but yeah, definitely weren't. And I can't remember if we talked about this before, but another research project I did was looking at the dress of early women mountaineers in the 19th century, using photographs a lot, and thinking about the records that they left behind, particularly memoirs, and they all wore corsets to climb mountains. They just did. But they're not tight lacing. You know, it's much more, I always think of it more in the way of wearing a bra, in the same way that we wouldn't consider going up a mountain I wouldn't anyway, without my bra on, nor would they have not worn their corsets. It was just normal.
It was just their normal undergarments.
Yeah.
This is what you wore.
Yeah, and it just seems different to us. We can't imagine that being every day. And that's where it you know, you start to create these myths around objects that weren't necessarily true.
But think about the girdles of the 1950s and early 60s.
Yes.
I mean, I wouldn't think about wearing one of those.
No.
And yet,
our grandmothers did, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure of it. But I have some postcards from the circa 1910 period, and the women are very nicely dressed, but their waists are so small.
I
don't imagine a postcard photographer like taking the time to, like, you know, how is he going to make the dress look right and all that? I can't imagine that. So I think it's a little bit of both, maybe.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the 1910s period is where you start to get more women being paid as professional models. That's the, kind of going from there. So women who are starting to kind of manage their appearance in a more kind of professionally controlled way. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. We could talk all day. We could go from here to talk about fashion myths. I could tell you what I see in photographs. We could compare them. Every time I look at your Twitter, I'm like, do I have a photograph of somebody wearing a dress like that? So I could like tweet it back at you, but so far not. But
well, when I'm sure one day
I will.
Yeah.
One day I will. What are you working on next?
Okay, so I'm returning to my royal roots, actually, looking at, again, at hidden women. I realized that a lot of my research has been about women whose stories are often neglected in some way. And so I'm going to write a book about the makers behind the scenes of royal suppliers. So the dressers, the laundry maids, dressmakers, tailors, cobblers, all of those kind of people, embroiderers, those people whose stories we never hear, but you see these kind of royal women sail forth looking spectacular and put together. And it's about all of the people that made that happen. And actually the royal women won't feature very much. They're kind of incidental. And so unlike the usual kind of royal fare where it's looking at the royal people themselves, this is about the ones that you never see.
Right. The behind the scenes people that actually make all the magic happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Kate, wonderful talking with you again.
And you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I'll be watching your Twitter feed. And I can't wait to have an actual copy of your book. So in the US, it comes out in the beginning of June. It's already available in the UK. I've already tried to get it that way, but it didn't work out. So we'll see what happens. And I can't wait to keep up with the other things that you do and have you back on the podcast another time.
Oh, anytime. Always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media, leave me a rating and a review. And if you know of a friend or family member who's also interested in family photographs, share this episode with them too. See you next time. I'm thrilled to be offering something new. Photo Investigations. These collaborative one-on-one sessions look at your family photos. You and I meet to discuss your mystery images and find out how each clue and hint might contribute to your family history. And trust me, these images can reveal so much in your research. I have decades of experience in the photo, genealogy, and history industries. This is your chance to learn from me and discover the stories in your family images. You can find out more by going to MaureenTaylor.com and clicking on Family Photo Investigations.